We're back with Backstory, the show that takes a topic from the here and now and explores its historical context. I'm Peter Onuf, Backstory's 18th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the resident 19th century guy.
I'm Brian Bellow, 20th century history guy. Today's topic, the history of the conflict between science and religion in America.
A fine biblical scholar, Bishop Usher, has determined for us the exact date and hour of the creation. It occurred in the year 4004 B.C.
This is another clip from Inherit the Wind, the movie about the 1925 Scopes monkey trial. The prosecution attorney, based on the fundamentalist icon William Jennings Bryan, is in the witness box being grilled by the lawyer inspired by the real-life Clarence Darrow.
That first day, well, what do you think it was, 24 hours long?
Bible says it was a day.
Well, it was no sun. How do you know how long it was? Isn't it possible that it could have been 25 hours? There's no way to measure it, no way to tell.
It's possible.
Then you interpret that the first day as recorded in the book of Genesis could have been a day of indeterminate length.
I mean to state that it is not necessarily a 24-hour day.
It could have been 30 hours. Could have been a week. Could have been a month. Could have been a year. Could have been 100 years. Or it could have been 10 million years.
In the movie, this moment is a kind of turning point. The William Jennings Bryan character is finally forced to admit a central flaw of biblical literalism. But in reality, it wouldn't have really been all that dramatic. The belief that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, an idea now known as young Earth creationism, was a fringe view in the 1920s. Ron Numbers, that historian we heard from earlier, he told me that most fundamentalists, including William Jennings Bryan himself, read Genesis metaphorically, with the individual days standing for vast geological eras.
And then there was this small little group associated largely with the Seventh-day Adventist Church that kept insisting, no, it's no more than 6,000 years, and they took care of the fossil record by assigning it to the 1 year of Noah's flood.
I see.
That was a view endorsed by the prophetess who founded the Seventh-day Adventist Church, Ellen White, and one of her disciples, George McCready Price, who wrote probably 30 books in the first half of the 20th century advocating this position. Almost nobody outside his church accepted it. And then in the 1960s, it was picked up by two non-Adventist fundamentalists, Henry Morris and John Whitcomb, and published as The Genesis Flood, which became the Bible for the creation science movement. And surprisingly, this alternative became extremely popular among fundamentalists, Pentecostals, and other conservative evangelicals.
And is it fair to say that the alternative that won out is the least scientifically plausible?
Of course. Well, it's so counterintuitive. You would think that there would be a tendency to accommodate science as much as possible. But the view that emerges more or less victorious in the 60s and 70s is the one that repudiates the most of modern science. Now, in the late 80s and early 90s, although the most vocal and visible group of anti-evolutionists had been now for a number of years the creation scientists, there were other anti-evolutionists. And they were a little annoyed by the insistence of the creation scientists on a particular interpretation of Genesis. So these people, with a few liberal young earth creationists, if there is such a thing.
I'm sure there's a group on Facebook.
I bet there is. Started the Intelligent Design Movement.
I see.
And the Intelligent Design Movement was supposed to be a big tent movement that allowed all anti-evolutionists to participate, that did not talk about the Bible. That was too divisive. Set aside the Bible. Let's just focus on arguments against evolution. But their biggest goal was to turn back 200 years. the consensus that in doing science, one would only appeal to natural forces. This had come fairly recently, actually, to be called methodological naturalism.
Mm.
And it had been embraced by evangelicals and atheists alike and was a wonderful device for keeping peace while people with different religious views participated in this activity. But the intelligent designers claimed that if you couldn't use God, then it was just as bad as denying God. And so their primary goal has been to change what I would argue is the number one ground rule for playing science.
Which is that to take God out of nature.
Exactly. You can believe in God.
Right.
You can worship God. You can talk to your Sunday school class about God and nature.
Right.
But you're not going to get by attributing anything in a scientific work to God or Satan.
Ronald Numbers is a historian of science and medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll post an extended version of our conversation at backstoryradio.org.
If you're just tuning in, this is Backstory. We're the American History Guys, and we're talking about the relationship between science and religion in days past. For the past few weeks, we've been inviting your feedback on today's topic at backstoryradio.org, and our producers have invited a couple people who left comments there to join us on the phone.
Hey guys, rally around. We have a call from Bellingham, Washington. It's Matthew. Matthew, welcome to Backstory.
Oh, hi. So, not all religions in the United States, really not all even Christian traditions, have the same sort of track record with science. And even using the same Bible, not all traditions have read Genesis the same way. And I was wondering if you could comment then on how these different belief traditions, even the ones that still, you know, have the book of Genesis, how they have different approaches to science.
Well, I guess it strikes me that the two most powerful faith traditions that are not sort of evangelical Christianity are Catholicism and Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that both of those have had quite different angles of connection and dissent with science. I'd be curious to know, is science problematic with Judaism in the 19th or 20th century?
You asking me based on my 4 years of Hebrew school, Ed, or as an historian? As an historian, I would say that as an organized religion, Judaism has probably had the easiest relationship with science.
Well, how about Catholicism then? I mean, one way to think about it is that Catholicism is in a different kind of sort of more corporeal conflict with certain varieties of modern science, and one thinks of reproductive debates and so forth. But, you know, and obviously long before Protestant Christianity sort of became established in the United States, the Catholic Church had been wrestling with science for centuries. So it's interesting how we narrowed the bandwidth so much to talk about in the American case of evangelical Christianity. And we don't really talk much about a conflict between Catholicism.
I think that's a great question. And I think it has something to do with authority and ecclesiastical authority in the organization of the Roman Catholic Church. So these issues, of course, have been and continue to be profound and important. But the kind of personal engagement that is characteristic of the Protestant tradition, where it's you and your God as mediated through the Bible, I think that makes every man, so to speak, has to be a scientist or an anti-scientist. That is, you have to answer these fundamental questions for yourself. And in a way, most believers in most faith traditions in the world don't, in an ongoing way, have to balance or resolve these problems on an individual basis, because their church hierarchies, their religious organizations are in a way deciding these things, usually in a way that enable a lot of play and a lot of slack, so people don't have to march to the same drum.
I mean, the great irony here is on the flip side. Science used to be what we associated with the individual natural philosopher, the inventor, the tinkerer, and it is now science
That's a great point.
Organized in these gigantic organizational
That's a wonderful point,
structures that require panels that sign off on the validity of grant proposals, that kind of thing.
It could be that there's a real antinomian appeal, that is the appeal of the individual believer, to stand up against the hierarchies of science, just as you once stood up against the hierarchy of the Roman Church.
Right. Have we totally confused you, Matthew?
No. I think, though, that there are issues of authority. But there is, you know, there's also sort of a theological direction to it as well. Part of it is I'm an Eastern Orthodox Christian, and coming from an older Eastern tradition, I in some ways older than Roman Catholicism, you know, coming out of the Middle East, we don't have a pope or a magisterium. We also don't have a lot of the same rationalism that came into theology in the Middle Ages. It's very mystical. But we've had a lot of freedom for scientists, and really very notable scientists, right up into the 20th century and the present day. And we actually even have a lot of freedom on the question of evolution. My faith has been described lovingly as disorganized religion. So there really isn't a definitive stance on a lot of these things.
But of course, Protestants are constantly engaging with these cosmic issues, but they're also monitoring each other. The individual believer is intensely concerned with other believers. So there's a real imperative to achieve some kind of, not consensus as if there were a compromise, but to get to a shared truth
a
and impose that.
A solidarity.
Yeah. And Tocqueville talked about mass society in the 19th century. The genius of American democracy is that people seem to believe the same thing. And that's no accident, because it comes out of Protestant religion, which is both incredibly diverse but also has powerfully conformist tendencies. And you don't have that kind of pressure toward conformity within more highly structured institutions, or even within a disorganized Greek Orthodox Church.
You guys are sharp.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye.
We've got another call, and it's from Margaret in Lumberton, North Carolina. Margaret, welcome to Backstory.
Hello, and thank you. My husband and I moved here a little over 20 years ago. And local lore held that a farmer that lived not far from where we lived at the time had beefalo on his farm, which, for those who don't know what that is a cross between cows and buffalo.
Right.
And somebody took offense to this and felt that it was the intermingling of species was wrong and murdered the man.
Whoa. And this is getting better and better.
And certainly, breeding of livestock was considered a gentlemanly pursuit at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Early research into genetics was conducted by monks. So clearly, you know, there was not the same kind of moral or religious meaning attached to things like beefalo. And so I'm wondering if, as we unravel nature's mysteries with cloning and embryonic stem cell and things like that, are we attaching more religious meaning or moral value than we did in generations past?
Well, listen, Margaret, it's a great question. One thing that came immediately to mind when you asked about the beefalo are some of the things that Thomas Jefferson said about race mixing, that if you loved natural philosophy, you wouldn't want to mix the races because nature had created them different. In some way, this was an imprecise proto-racial science argument, but it suggests that nature has a design and that we should not violate it. At the same time, somebody like Jefferson and people in his generation were in love with the idea of improved domestic livestock and that breeding was crucial to the improvement of the separate races. So one of the issues that it raises is, what is nature and what is nature's purpose, and is there a design in nature?
Yeah, you know, one word is troubling me here on all this, and that's mule. You know, I mean, mules have been around for a long time and are very obviously a human creation because they cannot recreate. Right. You know, it seems to me such an obvious challenge to the idea of the perfection and separability of species. But we know that people have been breeding livestock for centuries, right? I guess one way to think about this, in an era before Darwin, selective breeding did not seem as much of a challenge because you did not have any concept that the actual species could evolve or change, right? You're just improving them. You're just bringing to the surface what God's already put there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would just add that this can be seen in religious terms because of the requirement that man be productive and improve upon his conditions. And of course, in the 20th century, this really runs wild with all kinds of hybrid corn. A lot of this funded by the government in order to improve the quality of corns. And then by the time we reach the 21st century, genetic modifications. I don't have an answer for your question of whether this makes it more religious, less religious, or violates
I think that's
religiosity.
Just what Margaret's getting at, and that is the distinction between what Ed says about improving nature, and that's what we're supposed to do. And
right.
That's fully compatible with a notion of God's creation. But then somehow you can also be violating nature, and it's the boundary between improvement and violation, between doing something that seems to be in tune with some kind of harmonious larger design or end, and then the rampant violation of something that we should hold sacred.
That with the embryonic stem cell questions, that if we're using this to end cancer,
mm-hmm.
then people have less problem with it than if we're doing it to clone.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because if you think about what man is created for, it's to have dominion over nature,
right?
To quote the Bible, right?
I think we're also supposed to suffer, however. And I think if we're going to get theological about this, and suffering humanity is, it's not, it's of course, ever since the fall, it's what we're doomed to, but it's knowledge of our finite qualities, of our limitations, suffering as part of creation. And of course, the creation's design transcends us. It's when we substitute ourselves for that creation as if giving ourselves eternal life.
But speaking of finite, Margaret, I would just complicate further your very good question and not just think about modification, but elimination. And think about all the species that have been eliminated in the efforts to protect them. This, too, strikes me as a deeply religious question as to whether man is entitled to eliminate entire species of vegetation and animals.
Well, we've done it already. It's too late. Dope! Sorry, Margaret, you were going to say.
No problem. I was just going to say, I think that that is probably the question that then will keep us going as human beings.
Yeah. And I think you've done a wonderful job of identifying one of the things we will be arguing about. In many ways, religion and science are part of our engagement with these fundamental questions, different approaches, you might say, but perhaps ultimately complementary. And I think you've really drawn our attention
to
it.
Well, we just hope we've not made you suffer too much, even though it is our human fate.
Right.
No problem.
Thanks, Margaret.
Bye-bye.
Well, unfortunately, that's where we're going to have to leave things today. But as always, the conversation continues online. Drop by and let us know what you think. Will science and religion ever truly make peace with one another? You can find us on Facebook and at backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field, with help from Catherine Moore, Eric Verkirky, and Allison Quantz. Jamal Milner mastered the show, and Gabby Alter wrote our theme. Special thanks today to listener Josh Grizzetti, who suggested today's topic on the Pitch a Show section of our website. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by the University of Virginia. Support also comes from James Madison's Montpelier, Weinstein Properties, Trish and David Crow, Austin Ligon, and an anonymous donor.
Brian Ballow and Peter Onuf are professors in the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.